Good morning, gentlemen. My name's Stuart T. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here today. Today I'm I'll just get this out of the way real quick. I'm 476 days sober, thanks to the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's kind of it's a good news, bad news story for me. Prior, I had nearly 10 years of sobriety, and I'll get into that part of my story later, where how I ended up back down at these numbers. But I love the fact that you guys talked about the forward to the second edition. I've been in the Big Book now for 25 years. I came into these rooms in the year 2000 in a city called Milton, Ontario. It was a Tuesday night, and I remember going down those staircases and to that very first meeting. And I shared this last night. I went to a new meeting last night, and not unlike that meeting or this meeting, whenever I've walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or any 12-step program, I feel like I'm home. I love the foreword to the first edition. I always like to say I'm recovered, because it says in the foreword to the first edition, we are over 100 men and women who have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And I know that I can't be cured of this disease, and my experience has certainly shown me that. But I can recover from that hopeless place and the obsession of alcohol. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us that the book is really a textbook. It's precisely written in an effort to show how other these early on alcoholics recovered from alcoholism. And I'll start just briefly on that forward to the second edition. I'm a bit of a history buff at Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to Akron many times. And I remember my first trip I went to, it was real like old AA. There was six of us packed into a car. It was about 10 years ago. And we went down there. We had one guy who's going to have 50 years at the end of this month. So I was there with some real old timers, and there's some newer guys. And that meeting that we read about, happened May 12th, 1935. And I love the fact that the day before, on May 11th, Bill W. was at the Mayflower Hotel in Akron. And I don't know how many guys have been there, but if you haven't been there, it's a pretty spiritual place to be. And I think he was about 4.5 months sober, and he had been working with other alcoholics at Towns Hospital in New York, where Dr. Silkworth worked, and he had worked with thousands of different alcoholics. And he was at a, it's kind of an economic term, a bifurcation point. They had tried to do a stock deal to secure a company, and the deal fell through, and all his pals left him there in Akron. And he only had $10 in his pocket, which today is about $250. And the bar is, when you're there, the bar is to your left and the phone's to your right in the lobby. And it's one of those old fashioned phones. I think it's a mock-up phone that they have there now. And he went to the phone book, and I think most guys know the story. There's a great book called Pass It On. It's one of my favorite books, AA books. If you ever get a chance to read it, it's the history of Bill W. And it tells the story of how he was, at that point of looking over at the bar. And I got to tell you, if I had $250 in my pocket and I was away from my wife in a hotel in a foreign city, it'd be pretty tough not to be pulled back into that bar. I don't know if I could have done it. Right. But it shows the tenacity and why we're here today. And he got lucky. He calls it the 10 strike, I think, in the book, or something to that effect, like in bowling. There's, the old, for those of us old enough to know what a phone book is, there was a phone book there. And back in the day, they would have a bunch of priests and ministers' names in that phone book. And at random, he picked one, and the guy's name was Walter Tunks. Walter Tunks. And by luck, he was the most profound or experienced minister in Akron in the Oxford group. And Bill explained that to stay sober, I need to help another alcoholic. And that's what was working for him in New York. It hadn't helped anybody else really, but it helped him stay sober. And Walter gave him 10 names. And he vigilantly called 10 different people. And by luck or by chance, he got a Norman Shepherd, another kind of AA guy that was instrumental for Alcoholics Anonymous, gave him the woman Henrietta Seebeelings. And Bill called her, and he went over and met her at the gatehouse or the gate lodge, which is truly the most spiritual place I've ever been in. Alcoholics Anonymous is the gatehouse. If you, again, if you haven't been there, if you can get to Akron, get to the gatehouse or gate lodge. It was the guardhouse on the Seebeelings mansion, and I don't know if they were Uniroyal or they were in the rubber business, the tire business, and it's a huge estate. And the guardhouse is absolutely gorgeous. I usually used to have it as my background here on Zoom. I don't know if I do anymore. I don't think so. A picture of that. It's on my computer, actually, that house. And they met on May 12th. And it was what was supposed to be a 15-minute meeting turned into a six-hour meeting. And as articulated nicely in that foreword to the second edition, you know, what worked, why it worked, was, you know, Bill, Dr. Bob, who was also a member of the Oxford Group, and that's how Henrietta knew him. He had confessed his alcoholism to his group several weeks prior, so it's almost a miracle, right? How this all came about. And he was equipped with Dr. Silkworth's medical ideology. And it's quite interesting. In the first edition of the Big Book, Dr. Silkworth doesn't put his name in. It's not in the first edition because he was unsure. It was all based on empirical evidence of studying these thousands upon thousands of alcoholics when he worked at Towns Hospital, and he was paid $35 a week plus room and board. So, you know, doctors didn't make a heck of a lot of money back then. But anyways, Bill was equipped with not only you know, his description of what alcoholism was for himself. Dr. Bob already knew that. Dr. Bob kind of knew the solution, but he didn't know the problem. And Dr. and Bill W. knew the problem, and but he didn't really know the solution. So it was a real miracle how these two guys came together, and they ended up meeting for 6 and 6.5 hours, I believe. And the incredible thing about that, and we're coming up to the, I think, our 91st anniversary, is that you know, there's now, I believe, over 200 12-step programs, right? And there's, you know, there's men and women right now meeting all over, you know, the world this morning, for meetings. And happy Easter to everybody. I'm actually, I said to Jim, you know, I'm Jewish, so it was kind of a good, you know, where he found the second Jewish guy in the Niagara Peninsula that is an Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was quite thankful to have the opportunity to speak. This is about the 28th time I've spoken at an AA meeting over the years. I don't mind speaking. I quite enjoy it, and I think it's an important part of recovery for anyone that gets the opportunity to say yes to the honor of sharing your experience, strength, and hope, and or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's kind of where I'm going to start. You know, I was born in St. Catharines, Ontario, which is not far from Buffalo, as I'm certain all of you know, in 1963. And I don't have a story of tragedy as a kid. I grew up, my father was extremely successful. He was a very successful entrepreneur in the steel industry. In fact, I remember watching videos of Bethlehem Steel, which I thought of yesterday, which I think was a big organization in Buffalo at one time, and in the New York State area. He was super successful. I had two sisters, two older sisters. We were part of the Jewish community in St. Catharines growing up. And I have often kind of joked when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard the preamble, I thought it said there's no Jews or fees, so I didn't come for 7 years. It's not quite true, but sometimes it gets a laugh. I was the one thing I always noted when I was young was, you know, even part of the Jewish community, I was kind of like, I joke as well that I was kind of the only Jewish athlete. There's not really many of us. Most of them were studying math and music, and I was playing AAA hockey. That's why I'm a big Buffalo Sabres fan. My uncle used to bring the Sabres to his hotel in St. Catharines. He used to train in St. Catharines in the preseason. So it was always pretty cool. And we had season tickets to the Sabres. So I'm kind of delighted to be on this meeting. I was there in 1976 when I think Philadelphia won the cup in the Fog Bowl, if anyone remembers that, when they had to skate around with sheets and Hudson Bay blankets to get rid of the fog in the arena. Because I was playing hockey, I didn't go to Hebrew school, which is kind of like Sunday school, as often as I should. And I always felt like I didn't really know what was going on. And it really contributed to me feeling like, I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't fast enough. I come from an exceptionally bright family. And I'm kind of the black sheep. I'm the one that got the gift of alcoholism. My one cousin, Michael from St. Catharines, he programmed the Canadarm on the space shuttle, which is pretty cool. And I've got another cousin who won the Nobel Prize in 1982 for chemistry. And there was me who kind of just got by school, didn't really feel like I fit. And I tell the story. I remember back in about the year 2000 or 2001, I went to treatment. And in Nanaimo, British Columbia, and a guy came in to tell his story. And we always say try to identify, not compare. And I listened in, and he talked about how when he was born, he had some type of serious illness, and he ended up at Sick Kids Hospital in Toronto, which is a world-renowned kids hospital. And he was separated from his mother for 4 or 5 or 6 months. And it was like a detachment syndrome. And that was my story. When I was born, of all ironies, my liver didn't start. It certainly started when I got to university, but it didn't start. And I was in Sick Kids for quite some time. And back then they didn't have Ronald McDonald House and the Queen Elizabeth Highway, which is the highway to Toronto, as some of you know. Was only one lane, and your parents really didn't come to see you. And I often wonder, right? Is that why I've had this feeling of detachment and not fitting in, right? I call it a hole in my soul. And I've heard that chanted around the rooms for decades. So early on, Passover is Hanukkah is really not a big holiday in Judaism. I think it gets a little media attention, but the big holidays are Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, and Passover. And at the Passover dinners, I'm certain it was the Passover dinner when it first happened. But when you're around 11, 12, or 13, and you're there with your grandparents and that, I was able to take a sip of the red wine, Mogan David. I'm sure that's what it was, which is a horrible wine. And I distinctly remember being at my Uncle Ronnie's, who was a lawyer in St. Catharines, and taking that sip. And it filled that hole, It made me feel faster and smarter and capable, and I was able to, intellectually articulate nicely with my cousins, who were very bright people, and I fit in. And I always compare it to like a CD, when you burn a CD, and that event was burned into my brain, right? It was really the dopamine, but whatever it was, I liked it. And from that day forward, although my alcoholism didn't manifest itself to any great effect until I got to university and onward, I liked how I felt, and my brain liked it, and it wanted to play that CD over and over and over again. I was put into a Christian boys' school in St. Catharines around that same time, called Ridley College. It's a great school. But I was the only Jewish kid there. And it contributed me not feeling like I fit in. And believe me, boys' schools are, they're rough on you. They were pretty tough on me being the only Jewish kid there. And for a while, they made me go to the church every morning, which I felt really strange going there. And I remember I complained about it, and they decided, well, you don't have to go. So I didn't fit because I went, and then I didn't fit because I couldn't go. And it just made me feel more isolated. Eventually, I left that boys' school and I went to a normal high school. They didn't have girls there, and I thought, well, maybe I better go to a school that has some girls. And not unlike most guys, we were weekend warrior kids. We were good kids. We'd get some beer on the weekends. We used to a lot of times go over into Buffalo, into Niagara Falls, New York, over the river, we called it, because I think the drinking age back then was 18 in New York State, and it was 19 here. And we'd go over to the bars, you may know, the library or the press box or the Late Show in Niagara Falls, New York, almost every weekend. And it was an awful lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. I made it through high school. I would never drink during the week. It wasn't like we went out and did anything. Some of the stories you hear today about people drinking when they're 10, 12 years old, right? There was none of that with my gang of guys. And I went off to, I got accepted to the University of Toronto. So I got in by the skin of my teeth because my grades weren't that great. My kids are really smart. They get like 90s, and I'll laugh and I'll say, "Well, I only got 90s if I combine, two courses. I might get 90." But anyways, I went to the University of Toronto, and I had this ideology. I wanted to be a lawyer. It's kind of imbued in you when you're Jewish. You would be an accountant or a lawyer or something to that effect, right? And I remember getting there the first day, and they had an orientation. It was a camp out. I don't think they do this so much at university, but it was a 3-day camp out, and it was a drinking binge. It was an awful lot of fun. I met some great friends that I'm still lifetime friends with, but it all revolved around the pub. And our pub was called the Blind Duck Pub. And kind of to explain my story a little bit, that pub is now named after me. So I'm not so proud of that. Guys that go to these universities, they get buildings named after them. Me, they name the pub after a business that I owned. So it's a bit embarrassing, but that's the truth. So I went to the University of Toronto. I did everything but get involved scholastically. I was involved in sports. I was an intramural referee. I became a DJ. We had a low FM radio station at the University of Toronto. I was a DJ, did a Beatles kind of thing back then. I got involved in the student union. And I think my third year, I was elected to the as the vice president of the student union of my college. And my college was about 6,000 students. So it's bigger than a lot of universities. And college is just a college. University of Toronto is about 50,000 students. I started a business in university. It was called High Venture Tours. And there wasn't any reason for the word high, but we call it High Venture Tours. But maybe it was. And I would run bus trips from the University of Toronto to Niagara Falls, New York, for drink and drowns. And back then it was, we would charge $25 a ticket, and it was all you could drink, all you could eat, and we would make $10 a ticket. So it's unbelievable when you look back to then. I don't think you can buy two beers for that these days. But we for $15 we went to the library each time, the club there, the dance club. And for $15 it was all you could eat and all you could drink, and chicken wings were next to free back then, right? And then I know they started at what, the Anchor Bar, I think, in Buffalo. I remember in university we used to go to a on Tuesday nights to a bar called Raleigh Scagnetti's on Tuesdays, and it was 1 cent chicken wings. 1 cent, 25 cents, you were full. Your dinner, you were packed for a couple of days. I think they're a little more expensive than that now. Anyways, I stayed involved politically at the University of Toronto until about my fourth year. I still hadn't graduated. In fact, I never graduated. I'm like one course away from getting my degree in political science and history. My dad gave me that fateful call that we hear about so much, and said, "Son, get off your ass. It's time to come to work." And my dad hired me. He was running a large steel distribution company in Southern Ontario. It was a big company. It probably did 300 or 400 million back in the 1970s. So I don't know what that is in today's dollars, but so it was a big company, which I didn't really understand all that much about. But I was hired as an outside salesman, and which I really hated. Again, this feeling of not fitting in. Although I was an extrovert inside, I didn't like calling on customers. I was nervous. I didn't feel right. And it became, and back then in the 1980s, it was, in outside sales and in big industry, it was a lot about entertaining. And, and I liked that part. And I found customers that love to go out for lunch for 2 hours or 3 hours and drink, or after work. And that's the way it was done. I remember my dad used to have cases of Chivas Regal in our house and a lot of entertaining. So I was really exposed to that, part of business. Several years later, I was still pretty young. My dad had an opportunity to become a minority shareholder in a very small little company in Toronto called Clayson Steel. He had had some legal problems in Buffalo, actually, and he didn't take the shares and he put them in my name and he sent me to Toronto to get involved with the company. And I think it was doing about $1 million a year. So that's really, really small. That's a nothing company. It's a job shop, relatively speaking, in the steel industry, if even that. And I went there and I did super well. I got super involved and kind of ended up leading the business. And we built that 10x over 3 years. And at that point, unfortunately, the company my dad was operating went into bankruptcy. So I was now partners with a receiver. And there was a very, very large steel conglomerate that ended up buying that company, and they wanted to buy the business that I owned 25% of. And I couldn't get any assurance. We had probably about 35 employees by then that they, would protect the jobs. And I was young and arrogant, and I had a deal that would have, paid for my house. I would have, at 27 years old, I would have had my house paid for in a very nice area in southern Ontario. But I said no. And I met a, and I often get the opportunity to mentor young business guys and, or my kids, and I tell them like the word can isn't the word can't, right? And I didn't listen. I really didn't listen. And I had a business friend who became my mentor in business, and he taught me everything because I really didn't know what I was doing. And we ended up buying that company through a leverage buyout. Which is really shrinking the business and leveraging the assets to pay for it. And I think it was a multi-million dollar acquisition, and I didn't have any money. So it was kind of cool. And I remember we actually closed the deal on Christmas Eve because it turned out to be all the accountants and lawyers involved in the deal were Jewish. So we closed at Christmas Eve downtown Toronto, and I remember calling my dad, and my dad said, son, you've got more balls than anyone I've ever met. And that was really the best compliment he ever gave me. I think I kind of disappointed him after the fact. So I was off to the races. It was pretty tough, but I worked really hard. And I suffer with addiction, right? I'm addicted to everything. And one of the things was work. And we built that business. I had a good team of people around me, plus that business mentor. I often say too to people, I love saying to guys, you want to be the dumbest guy in the room because you don't learn anything if you're the smartest. And it's no different than that in the rooms of recovery, right? If you're the smartest guy, you're already on the decline if you think you're the smartest. And that's something I, again, teach my kids. I've got four kids, age 14 through 35. And my daughter, I'm proud to say, just had her 6th year of recovery last week. And she's married to a guy in recovery, and I've got two grandkids. And I'll just share on that real quick. I call it demonstrable recovery. When I was running my businesses, that older daughter, she didn't see me all that much. It was a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour business in the end. And I was crazy. I was working. It's like kind of Elon Musk hours, 20-hour days and weekends. When I came into recovery years ago, she saw a change in her dad, and I call it demonstrable recovery. And it pulled her into the rooms, right? I love when kids come to rooms. I took my kids to meetings for years, and I still do. So I really think the kids are the most important people at those meetings because we don't know if one of our kids will need that chair. We built that business. I got into lasers early on. Laser stands for light amplified through the stimulation of emitted radiation. And I became probably by the age of 35, the largest steel laser processor in North America. We used to make parts for Case New Holland. I'm sure you've heard of CNH down your way. I made all the parts for their skid steers. I made parts for Bombardier, their train division. I made parts for Skyjacks, or those scissor lift machines. I made all the parts in Skyjacks. And by the year 2000, I had 150,000 square feet of real estate in the Toronto area. And we were a going concern. We had maybe close to 300 employees, and then my life kind of fell apart. I had a beautiful house in Burlington, Ontario, along the lake, and my first wife. I've got two ex-wives. There's a chapter in the book called Two Wives, and I always laugh when I see that chapter. And, oh, I had two wives. She ended up having an affair. And as you know, that doesn't end well when you're an entrepreneur. We had a what was called a Bay Street divorce. She had like 11 divorce lawyers. And during that whole segment of business, the entertaining just continued and continued, in the drinking. I used to have 12 season tickets to the Detroit Lions, and we never really went to the Bills games, but we did a lot of business in Michigan. It's a big steel town or state, as you know. And we'd go to the casino or the Hilton prior to that being built, and we'd get RVs and go over to games, and it was absolutely crazy. And I wasn't it was just entertaining after entertaining after entertaining. And my first wife, she knew early on that drinking was a problem. I called her my jailer. And when we split up in around 2000, I didn't have that prison guard anymore, and my drinking really started to skyrocket. And I ended up having to sell my business to get through the divorce to another guy. It was a big automotive stamper, and I didn't listen to the law of don't get in bed with an elephant. But these guys were in the billions in sales, and we were a small little business, maybe a fraction of that in sales. And it went along okay for a while. But one night, and I'll say that this is part of my story too, somebody put another substance in front of me, and that just made it worse. I could drink more, and things really got out of control, to the point where one night, after a 2 or 3 day binge, and I had a second girlfriend at this time, and I hadn't shown up, I decided I got to go to treatment. And I went and saw my partner, and I told him, I didn't tell him where I was going, which I think obviously was a mistake. And I left, and I went for treatment for 4 months. And during that time, I was shotgunned out of my business. And the shotgun agreement is basically where two partners own 50%, and one can come to you and say, I'll give you $10 million, and it's put to you, and you have maybe a time frame of a week to go back and say, well, no, I'll give you the 10 million. So if the price isn't right, you're going to get bought out by your partner. In my case, because I was in treatment, I really didn't have any assets. My assets were all tied up in balance sheets, so I didn't have any cash. I got shotgunned out, and I pretty much lost everything. He gave me a gigantic haircut. It couldn't happen today, but it happened back then. And but I was on a pink cloud. I started my recovery. I came back from recovery. I still had a few houses and some assets, but not a lot relative to what I had. But I still had an ego. I went to treatment out in out west. I met women that worked on, as escorts on, streets of Vancouver, and I met girls that went to that guy's pig farm where he would feed girls he murdered. Like, it was crazy. And I thought, my God, I'm not all that bad. I'm okay. And I wasn't okay. And I came back, and I went to Milton, and it wasn't long, and I was back on the bottle. 4 or 5 months. And that was my pattern for about 10 years till about 2015. I got involved in a bunch of different businesses and consulting. I lived in Morristown, New Jersey in like 2010. I worked with guys on Wall Street and Hydroxyl Technologies, which was a really cool technology. But I left my family and my second wife, and I lived in Morristown, which is a great city. And blackouts started. And I could sell. I'm a good sales guy, and I could sell for 2 or 3 or 4 days and just load up the company with revenue, and then go sit on Long Island in a hotel and party for 2 or 3 days. And I started having blackouts, and that had never been my experience before. I remember one night I was at a bar, and I told the bartender in some type of dispute that I was with the ATF. Like, what a stupid thing to say! That wasn't. I was always kind of a happy-go-lucky drinker. And I was making terrible decisions, and I couldn't keep a job. I ended up partners in two or three different businesses, and my drinking really ended all of them. I was arrogant, and look at me, and it's unfortunate. Money was never a problem. I always did really well, but as I progressed, it's become harder and harder and harder. In 2015, I was at a financial bottom. I ended up going bankrupt, and I ended up having a suicide attempt. It was a fleeting one. I took like 50 lorazepams and some sleeping pills, and my doctor laughed at me after. But I ended up in the psych ward in Hamilton, Ontario, and they had a concurrent unit. And I know there's a guy in the hospital today, and I'll tell you, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. The concurrent unit was the first unit in Canada that focused on addiction and mental health. And I had really that day, very similar to Bill W. in his story of spiritual experience. And after that attempt, I woke up the next day, and my obsession for drinking, drugging, cigarettes, Coke Zero. I used to eat sunflower seeds like a bag a day for like 30 years. I was like a parrot. All of that was lifted. They offered out, there were NA meetings and AA meetings, concurrent unit meetings, 12-step meetings at the hospital. And I went, and it was funny because I was in with quite a few people, and I was the only guy that went to the meetings. And I remember it was again a Tuesday or Wednesday night, and I went to, I think it was an NA meeting that first night I went to. There was an AA meeting I went to. There was only one guy there. But I got back into recovery. I got back into the program, and I really went in full bore. I left the hospital, and I got super involved in the Grimsby in the Niagara Alcoholics Anonymous program. Like I said, I've been over that 10-year stretch, basically a 9-year stretch. I was our intergroup rep. I was chair of our business meeting. It was simple stuff, right? But I got involved, and I sponsored a lot of guys. I ran during COVID, as an example. I came out. I was one of the first guys, because I'm pretty computer literate, to be doing Zoom meetings just like this. I was virtual Stu, and on Mondays and Thursday nights, I hosted meetings, and I ran. There's a big meeting in St. Catharines on Sundays, and I was the host there every other kind of weekend. And I really got involved in recovery. I went to a lot of meetings. I've been to probably 3,000 plus meetings over the years. And like I said, when I first started, this is where, I don't know of any other thing that works. I mean, I know there's probably other ways to recover, but for me, it's 12-step programs. And I've lived in the Big Book for a long time. I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always laugh too. I don't know if anyone's got this, but that's the original dust cover of the Big Book, back in 1939. This was published. And like, you want to be anonymous, so print a book with red and yellow, and you can be on a train in New York. Nobody can tell you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's amazing the guys that put this book together. Bill W. was 3.5 years sober when he wrote this, and nobody else was sober to his extent at that point, and they were able to write this. I don't think I could write this book. There's no doubt. I really floundered. I really struggled to get work at that point. Because of my I was well known in the business community in the steel industry. So when I had lost my businesses, everybody knew, right? And because I it was not just alcoholism, but drug addiction too, right? And yeah, they in the steel industry, you can be an alcoholic and they'll hire you tomorrow. But if you've got multiple addictions, it's a little more difficult, right? And I was given some shots on goal, and I ruined them. And I ruined them. So my reputation wasn't all that great. In about 2022, I finally got an opportunity, and I bought another company with a guy. He financed it, and I got a small position in the business. And I had to move down to St. Catharines at that point. And I hadn't been back to St. Catharines in 40 years. And I came back to St. Catharines, and I started getting involved in the program down here. But I thought too, ego got in my way, and I was nearly 10 years in sobriety. And I thought, you know what, those guys over at NA, they need some guys with more time. And I kind of strayed away from AA. It was ego, right? And I started giving out food with a girl down in Niagara here. on Saturday nights. We'd give out 100 meals to the homeless. And I saw things I'd never seen before. And it's so crazy. And it talks about this in the big book, how we end up wanting, we're attracted to people that we normally won't mix with. And it was like a pull on me. And there was an emptiness inside me. And I was lonely. I was taking care of my 85-year-old mom, and I had to take over my kids. And one night I relapsed. I made that decision, and we'll get to that in the morning. I think that's part of why I relapsed, that I strayed away from my roots and how active I was in recovery. I picked up, and it took me until December. I just bottomed right out. I couldn't, once, they say, the obsession, you can't stop starting. You can't stop once you start. And I was off to the races, and I ended up the guy that I had partnered with, and he even fired me. And I didn't fight him. I could have fought him just based with the Employment Standards Act these days and HR, et cetera. But I just walked away. I felt terrible. And of all ironies, I got a God slap the other day. My roommate, I'm now in transitional housing, and my roommate got a job interview with that company. And I helped them get the job, and they've like tripled since I was there. That's what happens in addiction, right? We have to lose everything, really. By December 15th, 2024, I ended up living in my car, a broken down car. I was in Grimsby, Ontario. The car was it was freezing. It was the winter. I wasn't thinking clearly. I'd broken my femur, my rib, a finger, and I couldn't breathe. And I reached out. I really wanted to drive to what's called the Burlington Skyway, which was always a family joke with my dad, but I was ready to go and jump. And instead, I picked up the phone. I picked up the phone like Bill W. did. He made those 10 calls. I made one call. I called a friend named Pete out of Hamilton. Pete was there within hours. He's a crazy chaotic guy. I had actually hired the guy and fired the guy the year before at that business. But he was a long-term friend, and Pete was there. And we did what you're supposed to do. He got me. I was humbled. We got rid of the car, got a couple of bucks. He took me to his apartment. We blew up a mattress. Two guys in their 60s trying to blow up a mattress. It was a lot of fun. I did the very next thing I needed to do, right, which was to pick up the phone and call detox. I'd never been to detox before. My arrogancy hadn't allowed me to get there. But I picked up the phone. They said, keep calling every day. That night, we went to a 12-step meeting, and I was back on my recovery journey. I ended up in detox a couple days later. That was the next miracle. I went there, and it was at Christmas. Just after Christmas, they asked me to do a duty. You had to do some duties when you were there, take your garbage out and bring it back in, et cetera. And I couldn't do it because I couldn't breathe. And the next day, I ended up around December 27th, 24, ended up in the hospital, St. Joe's Hospital. I was rushed in by ambulance. The woman did an EKG. She ripped off the paper, ran out of the room, came back. And several hours later, I was told I have congestive heart failure. A part of my heart was at 30%. It was a possibility I'd die. I had a heart attack. And I remained in the emergency there for about 36 hours, believe it or not. And they finally got me a room, and I ended up in the transplant ward. And what had happened was my lungs were full of water because my heart wasn't pulling the water out of my lungs. I couldn't breathe, and I couldn't think. And the second treatment, they ended up putting some stents in and doing some reparations on my heart. And my heart, I'll tell you today, is a lot better than it was. They're quite happy. But they gave me Lasix. And Lasix is a diuretic, and it pulls the fluid out of your lungs. And it pulled the fluid out, and I could literally feel it, and my brain turned on. And it turned on like it hadn't turned on in 20 years. It was quite unbelievable. I remember almost immediately I sat down on my phone and I typed out like a 30-minute comedic piece for a guy. He wanted something on a website done. And my roommate was a professor from Dalhousie University. He was like 80. I started talking about books I'd read, like in grade four kind of thing. So my brain, I had low oxygen levels, right? Make a long story short, another call I made was to a men's recovery house in Thorold, Ontario, called Arid House. They run three houses. They put about 70 or 80 women through this house every year. They're absolutely a miracle place. And you can stay there for like 7 or 8 months. And I got a bed there right away. I think I had some help from some old AA guys to get me in there real quick. It's not easy to get into. I got in. I showed up. I was 61. It was super humbling, my arrogancy, but it was tough too because there was all a bunch of young guys and they were all in the pink cloud of recovery. And I had to learn not to say anything. They were going to a bunch of different meetings. I kind of knew where all the great meetings were to go to. And they were, back then, there was a lot of testosterone with these young guys and cell phones. And I just put my head down. And the miracle really started then. On January 6th, I got there. On January 7th, I opened my computer and I started to write. And I hadn't really written anything ever in my life. Certainly in business, I had to write bylaws and procedures and that type of thing. But I started to write, no I started a novel. And I started with one word, then I wrote 10, then I wrote 100 words. And by the end of February of 25, I had written my first book. By the end of June, I'd written my third book. And I published my first book on the anniversary of my near-death experience. So I published it's a science fiction. I've written four science fiction. It's part of a chronology. I just wrote an addiction and recovery book as well that some guys in AA asked me to write. And that's going to be coming out shortly as a free e-reader. I'll send Jim a link to it, but it'll be offered out for free. And it's kind of got my story in it. But there's a over the 25 years, I've kept some of the best quotes I've ever heard. I've got like 800 quotes from the Rooms of Recovery. And I turned it into a collection. It's called the Recovery Collection, 150 Voices of Hope. So there's 150 quotes in there and stuff on the steps. And I've been super active in sponsoring guys. I've done the steps all kinds of different ways. I've been mucked. I've gone through the steps traditionally. I've done back to basics and that type of thing. Here's a couple of quotes. I thought I'd pull out a couple. I think last time John heard me write, I read a poem that I wrote as well, but I'm not going to read that poem to you guys. It pulls the tears out of the women more so than the guys. Anyways, this one's from Tao Te Ching, and it's the journey of 1,000 mile be miles begins with the first step. I love that quote. Another one from Martin Luther King is, "You don't have to see the whole staircase; just take the first step." And here's my last one. I'll just read three of them. Addiction is giving up everything for one thing. Recovery is giving up one thing for everything. Right? It's changing our lives. I always it's right it's getting on the hour here and I always end in the same way. I'm a super advocate that it's a vocation in recovery that you got to help others. Clean house, find God, clean house, help others, right? My friend Johnny Action says it all the time. I think that's in the big book. And I always try to end with the starfish story. And it's a story, if you haven't heard it, about an old man and he's on the beach and he's going along and the tide's gone out and there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of starfish, and they're stranded on the beach. And this young whippersnapper, probably an addict, sees him. He goes, old man, what are you doing? And he tells him, he says, the tide's gone out, the starfish are stranded, and if I don't pick them up, they're going to die. And the kid looks at him and says, "Look, there's millions of starfish. It's not going to make a difference." And he picks up the starfish, the old man, and he throws it in the ocean. And he says, "It made a difference to that one, right?" And we can't help everything, everybody in recovery. We can try and find one guy or two guys, and help them. I often think too of the movie Schindler's List at the very end, when the 400 or 500 guys that had worked for him come out and they give him a gold ring, and he starts to cry and he says, "You know what, I could have helped one more guy," right? And for me, the secret to my recovery has always been working with others, right? And then one thing too I want to say about writing, I was going to read something out of the big book, but we're at the end, is it's I've concluded, because I've written like 500,000, I write every day, it's ridiculous. And I've got another book I want to start next month on recovery. And I've concluded, I'm just it's my power, it's a power. There's this power within me that I never had before. And I'm just the conduit, right? I'm the guy just listening to my higher power, right? And writing out the words, and my power, that power is really what's driving me. So I want to wish everybody a happy Easter, and a great 2026, and thank you again for the opportunity.